Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to New Books Network. I'm Galina Limorenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at EPFL in Switzerland, and I will be your host today. Today we'll be talking to Carlos Lalueza Fox about the new book, Inequality, A Genetic History, How Genomics Reveals Deep Histories of Inequality Going Back Many Thousands of Years. Well, Carlos, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you. Welcome.
So how are you? How was your week?
I had an hectic week, I think, because I have recently started as a director of the Museum of the Natural Sciences in Barcelona, which is quite a big institution. And I am still learning, at least learning the names of all the people that work in the museum and learning everything about the museum.
So can you tell us, what do you do?
What I usually do in research is I work retrieving ancient genomes from the past and analyzing these genomes, trying to reconstruct migrations, ancient migrations, and changes in ancestry, and also changes in social structure related to these migrations. And and that's it, essentially.
Oh, wow. That's very impressive. So how did you get interested in working in this field?
I don't know. When I was a child, I was interested in history. But then, I don't know, when I was young, I studied biology. And then after a while, I discovered that the emerging ancient DNA field that is just 20-something years old allowed me to put together this interest in the past with a biological focus, let's say. So it's thanks to the fact of being in the right moment, in the right place when this field was emerging.
Mm. And along your scientific journey in your career, did you have mentors that were very supportive of you?
Yes, I mean, the ancient DNA, I probably the person who has collaborated with most researchers in the ancient DNA field is a field which is quite peculiar in the sense that because it's young, there are many strong characters in, like, I don't know, Svante Paabo, Eske Willerslev, David Reich. I have been collaborating with all of them. I would say probably, as I say, that the person who has more papers with other people in the field, because I appreciate this is a collaborative effort. And also I am interested in collaborating with people that works in the past, but they are not geneticists, such as anthropologists, archaeologists, or historians. And I have, I would say, this view of the field as something that is essentially multidisciplinary, and also that is essentially something that is in many ways fascinating.
And what would you say to our student listeners and early career researchers, for example, maybe joining this field?
The field is now, I mean, if they have a fascination for understanding the past, for knowing things, and there are many subfields, let's say, not just reconstructing migrations, but how these populations shifts in the past are related to changes in social structures or gender biases or changes in language, for instance, which is entirely associated to many of these shifts, or also ancient pathogens, because sometimes when you are sequencing the persons from the past, then you are also sequencing the pathogens they had, or the pathogens that killed them. And also, of course, domesticates, extinct species. I mean, this is an enormous field. So if you are a curious person and you have this interest for understanding the past, but it's not for the past itself, and understanding how the present has been shaped by the past, I think is an interesting field for any student.
So your book is called Inequality, A Genetic History. And what inspired you to write it?
Essentially, I started with my own research. But the idea is that I noticed these studies were providing not only information about how the ancestry of the populations has been changing, a long history in different regions, but how these studies were allowing for the first time to understand how inequality has shaped the genomes of our modern populations. Because there is a clear link between wealth and biology. Essentially, the people in the past that had more wealth and more power, they were able to have more children and allow their children to survive also. And then this has to have an impact on the biology of the next generations, to the point that we can say now that we are the product of this inequality, because essentially we have to be in many ways descendants of the people that practice inequality in the past.
All right, so let's dive right into your book. And can we start with the very basics to make sure everybody knows what we're talking about? So can you explain what exactly is genomics?
Genomics is the study of the genomes, of the human genomes. Paleogenomics is the retrieval and the analysis of the genomes from people that lived in the past. And these genomics carries information not only about the ancestry of each person, but also information about medical issues, predisposition of health, phenotypical traits like height, pigmentation, eye color, etc. So is the starting of a very complex ramifications that you can study, as I say, from a population point of view, but also from a biomedical point of view, or even a phenotypical point of view.
So what kind of methods and tools do you use?
All this comes from quite recent technical developments that start in just 12 years ago with new technologies that allow now to generate from a single DNA extract literally billions of sequences of DNA that then you align to the human genome if you are working with humans. So essentially, now what we have is we extract a small sample of bone or tooth from a human remain. And we do just, a conventional extraction of nucleic acids. And then we send for sequencing in one of these new machines, the sequencing machines, these extracts, and generate literally billions of sequences that then computationally we align to the human genome and start doing the analysis.
And how easy or difficult is it to work with ancient DNA?
Well, it depends on many factors, because the DNA degrades a long time, essentially with influenced by the thermal conditions of the let's say the site. So the worst factor for DNA preservation is heat. But then it depends on, of course, of how old the remain is, or if it's in a cave, or you know, in the surface, or it's in water, or also some other factors like acidity of the soil, etc. So it can go from more than 1 million years, but this also only happens in very special environments, like you know, the permafrost. Literally nothing in very hot environments, like it could be, I don't know, the Africa, in the desert, let's say.
And how would you go about sequencing and extracting ancient DNA?
What do you mean? Is that kind of lab or...
Would you need specific tissues, like you mentioned, bone or?
Yes. I mean, there is a whole range of tissues. The best one is a specific region in the skull, which is called the temporal bone. If not, you can try with the roots of the teeth. If not, you can try with, long bones, with a strong cortical tissue, and then you can go down and down and ending up in kind of bones which are probably not suitable for DNA preservation. It depends a lot. It depends on many things. First, what do you have? Maybe you really just have a small bit of postcranial bone and then you cannot choose any other thing, or maybe the curator in a particular museum, because the skeleton is very valuable or is unique, then only allows you to sample a small piece of a bone, etc. So it really depends a lot. But we are using now a very small amount of bone. So it's although the technique is destructive, we can use now maybe 20 milligrams of bone. So in fact, it's less destructive, for instance, than the amount of bone you need for radiocarbon dating.
So why would you use genomics to probe our past? What can it tell us what other methods cannot?
It's very easy to put just an example. For instance, when we study skeletons, depending on the robusticity of the skeletons, we can deduce the sex, which is a very basic information to know if we are dealing with a man or a woman. But this is not always clear from the bones themselves. You know, so there are probably mans which are quite gracile, women which are quite robust, and even that is not. I mean, this is the most basic information you can have from a skeleton. Of course, trying to understand if that person is what was the sex of that person, the gender. And now with genetics, we know the genetic sex. So we can know to start. It is just the basic information to know if this it has an X and Y chromosome and then it's a male, or an X, two copies of X chromosome and then it's a female. And from here, we can know many, many things that were impossible to know just looking at the archaeology or the anthropology. Another example, we are now finding the kinship relationship, the genealogical relationships within a single site, where you can find who is the mother of who or who is the father of other people, and then you can reconstruct pedigrees. And this is just impossible in any place at just looking at the skeletons. There is no way you can really know if these two people, which are very close on each other, are in fact the son and the father, for instance. And not only that, we are now finding people who are family related, but they are not buried in the same place. For instance, we have an example which is still unpublished, where we have found a mother and a sun. And the sun is buried 700 kilometers from the mother. And as I say, this is absolutely impossible. I mean, it's a dream for any person working in the past. And I can imagine the excitement of archaeologists that have been working all their lives, guessing which could be, you know, the interpretation of this particular site if I could know the genealogical relationship of the people who are buried there. And now it's possible.
Oh, it's fascinating. So how do you use genomics to think and study inequality in the ancient societies?
Well, there are many ways. I devote each chapter to a different way, let's say. But for instance, one is very obvious and relates to what I've been talking. You have a particular site in any particular moment, let's say in the Bronze Age. And then in that site, there are people who are buried with, let's say, signs of wealth. They have gold, they have pottery, you know, daggers, weapons, whatever. And they are buried showing these signs of power alongside people who is buried with nothing. So there is a clear stratification, a social stratification in this site, because of course this is an indication of what do you expect to get in the afterlife. And now we are in the situation that we can analyze the genome of these people. We can discover how the wealth is transmitted in a particular site. Just studying the genome of the people who is buried with lots of signs of wealth and the people who is buried with nothing, essentially. And then we find, for instance, that those that show wealth, they have the wealth inherited through the paternal lines. So they are sons of fathers that were wealthy at their turn. We find, for instance, that many of the women, they are unrelated. I mean, they have children, but they never have in the sight either parents or brother or sisters. So clearly the women in this site where there is this strong stratification in the Bronze Age I'm talking, they came from other groups and they are in a difficult social position unless they have children within the clan. So this is one of the ways, which I think is very understandable, to study inequality with genomics.
Sort of taken in the context with archaeology and some other studies like carbon dating, for example, is it?
Yes, essentially archaeology, but also we can study inequality by looking at the modern populations and discovering how they have been shaped by inequality. And I would say that the most obvious example are the American populations nowadays, that have been the mixing of three main different ancestries, the European, the African, and the, let's say, the Amerindian, the Native American ancestry, in ways that are biased. And then when we study these communities in all along the Americas, we found signals of this bias in the sense that, for instance, there are communities in Central and South America, where when we look at the Y chromosome, which is inherited from the paternal line, we discover that the community, 100% of the Y chromosomes are European in origin. When we look at the mitochondrial DNA, which is inherited through the maternal line in the same individuals, we discover that sometimes 100% of them are Native American. So that clearly means that the population has been shaped by inequality in the past, essentially with European males and Native American women. And then what is more interesting is, of course, there is a story of social dominance here that we also know from history. But what is interesting is that this can also be extrapolated to populations in North America, when we find, for instance, the Black American community they carry on average 24% of European genes. And most of them also have Y chromosomes, which are European. And they are still considered African Americans because the genes go from the European community to the, let's say, African community, Afro-American community, but they don't go the other way, the other way back.
So can you use this technology and these approaches to study migrations of the ancient societies?
Yes, I mean, the, in fact, the most obvious thing is to reconstruct past migrations. This was, let's say, the first goal of the paleogenomics when they was established with the new technologies was trying to understand how past migrations has shaped the genetic distribution of modern populations. What is interesting of the past migrations associated to inequality is that they are a opportunity for inequality. Not always, but these past migrations, sometimes they are clearly gender biased in the sense that we can trace that the most of the migrants are, for instance, males, and then they marry, I mean, they mix with local women, etc. So the association with inequalities, at least there is an opportunity for inequality to happen when the genetic change is large.
Is it possible to know whether these migrations are forced or voluntary?
Yeah, it depends. I think it's quite variable. Of course, the most obvious migration is the spread of agriculture that develops, if we are talking about Europe and the Near East 10,000 years ago, and then the people start pouring into Europe, carrying their own ancestry, and in some places replacing the previous hunter-gatherer ancestry, in other places mixing with the hunter-gatherers. And then there are other migrations that happens across history. Some of them, I would say that the migrations are sometimes triggered by new technologies like the horse domestication, sometimes new weapons, sometimes both things. In the case of the agriculture, of course, the possibility of cultivating and producing plants, crops, and also having domestic animals. In general, when inequality happens, is because there is some dominance. So the migrants are either, let's say, they have a new technology or they have a new weapon. So it's, let's say, novelty over traditional societies, probably the impact, the stronger impact in terms of inequality.
And how has the ethnic composition and mixing of the different ethnical backgrounds contribute to the inequality?
We have to imagine the ancestry of modern populations as a kind of layers. Unless there is a complete replacement, which is rare. Let's imagine that every time that the migration happens, then you get this new layer of ancestry. So the original layer gets lower, let's say, and then it's like a cake. So depending on the number of migrations, you have layers of a cake. And then this shapes the composition of modern populations. And of course, I don't know if it's a possible thought would be that to know that some of these layers have practiced inequality in the past, and then but then you have this ancestry in your genomes. In fact, as I mentioned before, the likelihood is that the people who had practiced inequality in the past, it is more likely to be some of your ancestors. So there is this, I don't know, at the personal level, probably is kind of
difficult to understand.
And within sort of one population, how did it impact the social order and sort of stratification of the society?
Yeah, there are some signals of strong social stratification associated to some of this migration. I guess the paradigm is in India, where we are now finding evidence of people with what we call a steppe ancestry, people that came from the steppes of Central Asia, because an ancestry which is very distinct to the ancestry that is before in India. And at the time this happened, more than 3,000 years ago, what probably occurs is they established a very strong social stratification. Of course, they put themselves in the top layer. It wouldn't make sense. You know, if you create a stratification, you put at the lower. And this is shaped, and a long time it becomes the caste system that is now, let's say, illegal, but still very strong in the Indian societies. And we can study the population either geographically or by social layers. And then we found this steppe ancestry, which is, you know, more dominant in the upper layers of the society and almost nothing in the lower layers. So this, again, is interesting because relates culture, biology, and also social structure. And it's very persistent. It's incredibly strong, even now that it doesn't, you know, has any legal support, but it is still going strong because in some of the statistics the government has published recently, in some regions, more than 90% of the marriages take place within your caste. So you don't marry outside the caste. So the thing goes on and on after hundreds of years, to the point that if we now make an ideal population where there are no layers of society and everyone mixes at random, it will take about, you know, several hundreds of years to have this ancestry diluted to, you know, share at the same level across all the population. So I think it's very interesting to see the persistence of these social structures.
Yeah, this is really fascinating because we had just several hundreds of years, didn't we?
Yes. But the other interesting thing is this is an extreme example, but there are, let's say, there are hints that the stratification also operates in Western societies where we think they are much more egalitarian, but there are studies that basically looking at the surnames, at the surnames of the nobility several hundred years ago, and now just the surnames of the common population, and looking, correlating the surnames and the income, it always, in many Western societies, including the, you know, Sweden, Great Britain, etc., when you look at that, the surnames that were from the nobility hundreds of years ago, they still have higher income than the average of the society.
So then what are some of the reasons that inequality emerged and was maintained throughout our history?
Yeah, I think it probably exists, but from the beginning, but it's much more difficult. I mean, at least it's attenuated, let's say, or exist in a different way in hunter-gatherer societies where you cannot really accumulate much wealth because you have to transport it constantly. So the first thing you need is that it became sedentary, where you can stay, you know, in the place to accumulate wealth, but also you have to create a kind of surplus. And this happens with the emergence of the agriculture, where you can have a surplus of, let's say, crops. You can have more and more land. And this create, I would say, this the starting point of the inequality. But clearly, when we look at the genomes of the past, there is a boost of inequality in the Bronze Age societies, at least in Europe. So around 4,000 years ago, between 4,000 and 5,000, what happens is that society becomes much more stratified. And then there is the emergence of the elites. And these elites, they clearly can accumulate much more wealth, and they can transmit the wealth to their offspring. So there is an inheritance of wealth that then, you know, relates again to biology. So is the turning point, I would say, the Bronze Age.
Are there any examples of equal societies throughout our history?
Oh, that's a good question. of course, I guess we should probably go to the foragers that still exist in some places in the world, which are, but I'm not sure. I mean, they are, some of them, they have aggression also. They have conflicts. And so this is another thing. I think there is a tendency to aggression in not only humans, but in many primates societies. And then this is also the base for subsequent inequality. So I'm not sure if equal societies are possible in many ways. Equal societies, they have been, I talk about this possibility in the book, also in a chapter, because they have been imagined, let's say, in literature through utopias. And so the people has been concerned about inequality for thousands of years, because when it starts, the first utopia starts with Plato. And then they have been imagining these ideal societies where everyone will be equal and happy, let's say. When these societies, they have been implemented with the utopic socialism in the 19th century, in some places, again, notably in the Americas, because, you know, it was the new world, it seemed you could do something new there, they all failed. They all failed, even if it was a rational planning of a society that was going to be equal, yeah, everyone was going to be happy. And maybe is, let's say, it is impossible to be happy in many in human societies as a base.
So how did inequality sort of evolve during the sort of closer history after the Bronze Age?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, of course, there are many examples of incredible wealthy people with hundreds of children, literally described in history. I don't know, pharaohs in Egypt, or very recently, I don't know, sultans, Ottoman sultans, or I don't know, the sultan of I don't know where, you know, or the king of Swaziland that maybe have 100 children and so on. So there are many examples of extreme inequality where every you know, just few people have everything. And now this can be, in the last hundreds of years, this can be studied by checking the taxing, at least in Western societies, where, you know, then you can see who is owning what. And then there are some researchers, these are economists, let's say, who claim that Western societies are now much more unequal than they have been in the past. So because some of the figures are all incredible in the sense that maybe, I don't know, three people in the world own as much as half the humankind. You know, so maybe 3, 4, 10 people, they have the same wealth as two or 3 billion people together. And of course, this up to this level, it probably didn't happen in the past. And this is, of course, a concern, not only for economists, but a social concern, because in the past, when societies has been at some point extreme and equal, they have become also very unstable.
So now thinking about the contemporary societies, how are genomics used to study inequality in our world now?
The genetics, let's say, if you study now genetics, you are projecting to the past. But this will continue in the future. If wealthy people, for instance, tend to mate among them, which is what we call assortative mating, these will create genetic differences that will go on and on in the future. And the geneticists in 500 years, if we are still here, then we'll see the signal of inequality is still, you know, changing, probably, but shaping still the genomes of the future societies. So the genomics kind of study inequality, looking at the past, but in fact, inequality is something that will continue shaping human populations.
Hmm. And how do reproductive technologies and something like genetic testing, IVF, contribute to maintenance of inequality?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, there are many things that can be operating now in a new level. For instance, gene editing. Of course, wealthy people is very concerned with the idea of dying, like the rest of us. And they are, you know, funding all these initiatives to try to live longer, or, you know, maybe forever. So clearly there are new steps in genetics and inequality that didn't exist in the past and maybe will operate in the future. But in my view, the most strong mechanism is this assortative mating. Some generations ago, there was less structure on that. So the people, some wealthy pair people would marry people less wealthy in the society. And this has been now more structured according to new studies. So the people is clearly tending to marry and have children, of course, with person of the same educational level and similar income. And this is quite new. This has happened in the last two or three generations, for instance, in the United States. Mm. And of course, this is a mechanism that is slow, but it's very strong also.
And how concerned are you about the bottlenecks of population? For example, thinking about secluded populations, maybe like Iceland, or even thinking about the monarchs in Europe, where they have very high levels of inbreeding.
Yeah, that's another interesting thing we also are able to study now in paleogenetics, the level of inbreeding. And then we see in some of these communities that have been subjected to migration, some of them, the inbreeding increases as a reaction, probably, at least in the first moment, to this arrival of foreign people. So this is a thing that I didn't mention, but it's also possible to see the level of inbreeding, which is very strong in some ancient populations and small communities. We have been studying in the Mediterranean, in Greek times, in Punic times, people that really tend to marry, and it has a very strong signal of inbreeding, and tend to marry with cousins and just keeping probably their own identity as a defensive against what we can imagine was the globalization at that time. And this can also happen in modern societies, although globalization after the pandemics is not as clear as before. It's unclear if globalization has
you know, start declining. Some people claim some years ago that globalization was going to be a uniformizing mechanism in genetics. There is the reaction of, you know, fighting against globalization, increasing the endogamy in your communities as a reaction. So, yeah, that's very interesting. And again, it could happen not in physically isolated populations, but in communities that want to keep their own cultural identity. So you don't need to be on an island to become more endogamous.
And what lessons can we learn from our history?
I think we learn a long story of suffering and, you know, and sorrow, I'm sure. I mean, there were probably some love stories in these interactions, but clearly there were many stories of power and dominance and people who some people couldn't survive, but many people couldn't have children at all because others were having, you know, many more children than them, or simply monopolizing all the women. And the women is another fraction of the society that really has been in a long story of discrimination and suffering. And this can be studied now, as I say, directly in space and time. But on the other hand, the society survived, let's say, and we are here talking about this story of inequality and discrimination, which is our own story. I think this can be a positive message.
And looking at what we see in the world today, where are we heading in the future in terms of inequality?
I think it will continually increase. And this, I say this is a concern, because every time that historians or economists has been looking at moments of increase, continuous increase and extreme inequality, this has led to some serious instability, because at the end it's impossible to keep the society under these circumstances. And in moments where crises are coming, such as the climate change, for instance, the combination of rampant inequality as we have and this coming crisis, I think is it can be a serious danger for the structure of the society.
And where would you want to see us head in the future?
I mean, ideally, I would like to see a kind of control of the, as you know, of the inequality. I don't know. It's just how this can be done. I don't have any answer. Of course, some people have been arguing about increasing taxes, etc. But I think it eventually will happen, because we'll have to face new challenges probably associated to many things that will probably happen in the future. And then inequality will be one of these challenges. But I would like to be able to, let's say, talk about these things and plan these things rationally before it is too late.
Yeah, and a very interesting thing you pointed out earlier, that we indeed never had societies that were truly utopian. We dreamt about them, but in practice, it's really difficult to achieve. So do you think we had some sort of societies that were sustainable and with a lower level of inequality throughout our history?
Yeah, I mean, clearly we had, because, the levels of inequality, it's impossible to compare any society with the past society. It wouldn't make any sense, because we have now internet, we have you know, people who owns Twitter and I don't know WhatsApp and things that didn't exist. So any comparison is impossible. But even societies that were perceived as extremely unequal in the past, our society is probably much more unequal now than these past societies. But then I am not advocating for, you know, going back to being hunter-gatherers, something like that. Of course, it's something that is new. It's something that has to be shaped and has to be worked out. And I think we have also some advantages as societies that we didn't have in the past, like the possibility, as I say, of being talking about that.
I'm thinking about the bigger picture. So are you optimistic that our society will be able to achieve more equitable set of, order in the world?
I am optimistic because I have children and then I have to be optimistic in many ways. I think we are still in time of facing not only the social challenges, but also ecological challenges. Because as I said, although we are facing big problems ahead, we also have tools that we didn't have in the past. Even the idea of humankind working together is not really as old as we might think. It's just an idea that maybe associated to the United Nations, it maybe is only, I don't know, 50 years old or something like that. So everything is changing and everything is still possible in my view.
And what discoveries in your journey to writing your book Inequality surprised you the most?
I don't know. It's just the perception that this was possible to study. This was partially, I have to say, triggered by the studies I was doing many times in collaboration with David Reich from Harvard University. And he also wrote the book about this emerging field, which is mainly focused on the analysis of ancient migrations. But also, he has a small section in his book about the possibility of studying also the history of inequality. And talking to him and collaborating with him, this was something that, you know, trigger these ideas to be put in a book. But what really happens to me is that I was in lockdown during the first outbreak of the COVID pandemic in 2020. And then I was locked at home and then I put together these ideas in a book. So probably if I didn't have the lockdown that in Spain lasts for, I don't know, 4 months or something like that, I couldn't find the time to put these ideas together.
And you yourself, do you have your genome sequenced? Have you tried tracing your ancestry?
Yes. I tried one of these commercial companies. I will not say the name. Because, first I had it because with my wife, when we were planning to have children, we wanted to know if we had some, let's say, mutation that could be a problem, you know. And then I have my background. I know my background quite well, although it's quite, you know, unusual for Spain because I had a grandfather who was English, although he died before I was born. And then the company detected that I am 25% British, which is interesting. And then they detected, for instance, that I could have an ancestor in Italy around the mid 18th century, which is interesting because it's at the same time it's too far away to have family history on that. But they seem to be quite sure about that. So it's interesting. And again, I think it shows the idea that everyone is a mosaic. Every population is a mosaic of different layers of ancestry, as I say, but every person is also a mosaic. It's very strange that you could have all your, four grandfathers, eight great-grandfathers, etc., from the same population across hundreds of years. And if you go down, you know, back in time, then you start finding these connections with other places to the point that you can really say that you are connected to everyone if you go back in time enough.
Mm. Were you curious to find out whether you were, I don't know, sensitive to caffeine or something like this?
Yes, I had this, but I knew some of them. Of course, I for instance, I am quite intolerant to lactose. I have a copy of the mutation, so I can digest some milk, which probably comes from my grandfather, because in England, this is almost fixed as a mutation, but not so in the south of Europe. And then there's a whole list of, let's say, curiosities. But probably the most interesting list is associated to health issues, of course. And I have hypertension, and of course, in my genome, there is a risk for hypertension, which I knew in advance.
Well, this has been a truly insightful discussion. So what are you working on now, and what will be your next project?
Yes, I am trying to get out of humans in many ways, because we are getting close to the present times. I have literally hundreds of genomes which are still unpublished, most of them from the last hundreds of years, and this will be very interesting. We have found some really amazing things still associated to new migrations and so on. But I am trying to study now extinct species, because I am more concerned about the crisis of diversity. And I would like to not only retrieve genomes of a species which are extinct now, or ancient genomes of a species which are now endangered, but also would like to explore the possibility of changing some genes in modern species which are critically endangered to make them more able to survive, for instance, to climate change. Because some species can adapt, but the climate change is going too so fast that I think one possibility would be to tweak some genes that allow some species to adapt much faster to this climate change and then survive. So this, this of course, is a long-term project, but it's, the thing that I would like to explore in the next years, if I can.
Oh, wow, sounds very exciting.
Yeah, that's it. Yes, yeah. Again, this is thanks to the new technologies that didn't exist, for the possibility of the CRISPR that emerged, I don't know, 10 years ago, and the possibility of doing this kind of thing. So technologies can also help us in conservation issues. It's not the question of just protecting in a zoo the last specimens of a given species, but trying to make them help survive and adapt is I think is a responsible and active way of fighting against the biodiversity crisis.
And what would be the best way for our listeners to find more information about your work and also your book?
Well, reading the book, I guess. I don't know. Is any other thing comparable? There are other books on inequality in the past. For instance, Thomas Piketty had these books on inequality from the economical point of view, the famous one that was published some years ago, Capitalism in the 21st Century. There are books about the inheritance of wealth, as I mentioned, associated to surnames. So inequality, the funny thing is, it can be studied from many different angles, not only the genetics, which links several of these disciplines, like genetics, archaeology, history, etc., but also it can be studied, of course, from an economic point of view, from studies related to social structures, surnames, etc. So I think that people should try to grasp these different angles to try to understand the problem.
And your book, Inequality, where is it available to get? For example, is it available in the smaller booksellers or on the big sellers online?
I have no idea. Really, the big sellers online is what the people is now using, unfortunately, because of the pandemic. So at least myself, I was buying books online in the last 2 years. I guess it can be found, especially in right now in North American shops in Canada, I know, also in Great Britain. And there is a translation to Spanish that will be published early next year also. So then it will be available in many bookstores in Spain, but also in South America, I hope.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks to you for your questions and your time.